Vraiment un honneur absolument insigne et un plaisir que je ne saurais dire d'accueillir ici le professeur Lewy, qui est une sommité dans le domaine des études chinoises que beaucoup d'entre vous connaissent, et avec qui j'ai eu l'immense privilège de faire une partie de ma formation doctorale à Cambridge il y a 30 ans. Et c'est sans aucun doute vraiment sans exagération aucune le meilleur spécialiste mondial de la dynastie Han, dont je rappelle pour ceux d'entre vous qui n'êtes pas sinologue que c'est une dynastie qui a duré 4 siècles entre le 2e siècle avant l'ère chrétienne et le 2e siècle de l'ère chrétienne, une période absolument cruciale car en grande partie fondatrice des structures impériales chinoises. Le professeur Lewy a été d'abord formé à Oxford, à Cambridge, c'est ce qu'on appelle « the other place », et en études classiques. Donc, il a eu déjà une formation d'excellence donc en latin et en grec. Il a ensuite obtenu son PhD, donc son diplôme doctoral à l'Université de Londres, où il a enseigné quelques années avant de devenir donc professeur à Cambridge, où il a fait donc la majeure partie de sa carrière jusqu'en 1990, date où il a pris sa retraite. Donc c'est vraiment un honneur qu'il nous fait donc en venant nous rendre visite ici à Paris. Alors, je ne passerai pas trop de temps à énumérer toutes ces publications, car elles sont très nombreuses. Disons qu'elles portent pour beaucoup sur cette période Han, qu'il connaît vraiment mieux que quiconque. J'en rappellerai quelques-unes. Vous avez bien sûr donc les Records of Han Administration en 1967. Quelque chose qui est plus destiné au grand public, qui s'appelle Everyday Life in Early Imperial China During the Han Period. Ensuite, vous avez cet ouvrage qui a fait date, donc Crisis and Conflict in Han China. Un livre sur les croyances de la dynastie Han, donc concernant la vie et la mort, Chinese Ideas of Life and Death. Vous avez également donc Divination, Mythology and Monarchy in Han China. Et comme le professeur Lewy est loin d'avoir pris une retraite oisive, il est même beaucoup plus actif depuis qu'il est à la retraite, puisqu'il nous a donné donc un très important dictionnaire biographique des Qin, des Han antérieurs et de la période Xin, c'est-à-dire donc de la période de Wang Mang, qui est un instrument de travail indispensable pour beaucoup d'entre nous, avec donc plus récemment un companion à ce dictionnaire biographique. Et bien sûr, c'est lui qui a coordonné donc un autre livre de référence qui s'appelle Early Chinese Texts, Bibliographical Guide, publié en 1993. Et bien sûr, on le connaît aussi pour son édition donc du volume concernant les dynasties Qin et Han du Cambridge History of China. où il a également en fait apporté un complément donc tout récent, donc daté de 1999, sur cette période. Alors, avant de lui donner la parole, je vais donc accomplir ce rite habituel à notre institution, c'est-à-dire donc lui remettre une médaille Collège de France, vraiment avec beaucoup de plaisir. Donc, merci à vous.
Et je veux vous dire merci bien, merci très bien. Votre invitation d'être ici, de donner présentation au Collège de France, ça donnait moi grande joie et vous m'avez fait grand honneur. Je veux remercier très. Mais si vous voulez, voulez-vous m'excuser, je ne parle français comme vous. Comme vous connaissez, je ne parle français que très mal. Eh bien, pour éviter l'effort de transmission, c'est bien que je parle en langue anglaise. Je connais très bien que les Français comprennent la langue anglaise bien. Les Anglais ne comprennent la langue française que mal. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to be here in this very renowned setting of the Collège de France. I'm happy to say I have been here before, but each time it is an even greater pleasure. Now, I'm going to start by asking some major basic questions on the question of Confucian values and the practices in Han China, which you will know extended from 202 before our era until 221 after our era. Now, we may all read in the basic accounts of Chinese history, whether written by Westerners or by Chinese, we may read that in the books in which we were nurtured, we were brought up, we read that the 2,000 years of imperial China is characterized as Confucianism, Confucian. We read that the prominence of Confucianism was traced to the teachings and the practices of the Han Dynasty. And the Han Dynasty, all 400 years, is seen as a continuum. And it is seen, particularly, it is always described as being in reaction against the cursed predecessor of the short Qin dynasty. And we are told that in all this, it is the precepts, the traditional sayings of Kunzi that played a dominant role in concentrating the minds of philosophers, writers, historians and officials. This is the rule which we read about in Western writings. Certainly since the time of Otto Franke, who was publishing in 1917, just a century ago, and then a few decades later, we read this in the writings of Homer Dubbs, finally at Oxford, who coined the catchword, the victory of Confucianism. I think he coined it. He may have accepted it from somebody else. I'm not quite sure. And he applied the victory of Confucianism to the later decades of Western Han, that's to say from 70 before our era onwards. Now, let us remind ourselves that the term Confucianism was adopted first by the Christian Protestant missionaries of the 19th century, not by the Jesuits who were there before the Protestants. It was the Protestant missionaries who first used the term, and it has served as a translation for our own Chinese expression of Ruzhou, rightly or wrongly. Now, certainly we can say that there was a devotion to Ru, to traditional learning, in Han times. Whether we are right to label this as Confucian or not is perhaps a question. Did the idea, the system that the writers of the 19th century called Confucianism, did that system, that idea, really exist in early imperial times? And if so, in what ways did it affect public life? If there was a victory of Confucianism, who was the enemy? Who was conquered? And with what ideas did such a system or mode of thought have a conflict? There are several dangers that we face when we are addressing this question, with which I am sure you will all be familiar. Firstly, that of anachronism, that is, of applying later ideas to something which occurred much earlier, as if they still existed. And secondly, we have to beware of the assumption that the modes of thought formulated in Han times in different schools or jia or lineages, we have to avoid the assumption that these were exclusive, that you were Ru, you were Fa, you were Dao, and had no room for anything else. I do not believe myself that human intellectual societies ever grew up or developed in that way. They may have pressure to do so, but usually they do not succumb, and I do not see why on earth they should have done in this time. The assumption is due in the first place to the writings of Sima Tan, who set out his scheme of six ways of thought, as he saw it, which he called jia, incidentally, specialists rather than schools. And it was also due to the later writings of Liu Xiang in about 20 or 10 before our era, who was drawing up not so much a catalogue of books, but a way of arranging books on the shelves of a particular library. Well, I'm going to name six characteristic elements of what was taken later quite correctly as being Confucianism, fundamental to Confucianism. I'm talking of Tang, Sung, Ming, and Qing times, and I'm going to try to trace the existence of these characteristics or modes of thought to the early empires. The six are, first of all, a respect for the values and teachings named by Kunze. Respect for Kunze, his ideas, and his disciples. Secondly, the insistence that certain texts, five to start with, much later it became 13, that certain texts, including some with which Kunze's name was associated as the author, were of prime, paramount importance, and that they were selected as the basic material for training officials, for guiding the intellectual growth to the elimination of others. That's the second characteristic I'm going to talk about. The third one is the acceptance of heaven as the almighty deity with prescribed acts of reverence and the fount of authority which was exercised over human beings. My fourth subject concerns human organization, which, if properly contrived, is dependent on the ideas of hierarchy and rank. You see this in reverence for ancestors and relations within a family. You see this in the acceptance of superior, inferior ranks in public life. One commanding and one obeying. The fifth subject, in historical terms, the kings of Joe and their rule was seen as the supreme one of all times, to be emulated, blessed as it had been by heaven. And finally, the conduct of religious cults, social relationships, administrative and government, all being dependent on the prescribed rules of li, or conduct. Consideration of these subjects must perhaps take account of two major changes that took place in Han time in intellectual terms. First, a change between the foundation in about 202 before our era, and then in 50 before our era. A change from inheriting the thoughts and ways of the Qin Empire to paying attention to the mores and the ways of life of earlier ages. And a second major change as between Western Han and Eastern Han, seen in the intellectual focus and in religious terms. So let us look more closely at these six points. Could we have the next one, please? Thank you very much. Now, we started with the person of Kunzi, the value of his writings and sayings. And we find that this is very rare in statements for the first 70 years of Western Han. They feature in the three responses made by Dong Zhongshu, probably in 134 before our era. They feature there, and those responses we believe to be authentic. It is very rarely that you see a reference to Kunzi in imperial decrees. They are not seen to support the memorials of officials until perhaps 50 before our era, when we find a markedly increased frequency. But we've got to wait even further for the rule of Wang Mang, coming on to first decades of this era. We've got to wait for Wang Mang and the Eastern Han emperors for even more constant references to Kunzi, for direct acknowledgements that some ideas come from his statements or the account of his statements in the Lunyi. And I would point out that the sacrifices of Kunzi are by no means regular or frequent in Western Han times. And when is the Lunyu first seen as educational material for teaching an emperor to be? Not until the time of Xuanti, who became emperor in 74, and his successor Yuanti in 48. Now, my second point concerns familiarity with those so-called classical texts, Wujing, and the foundation of the Taishuo, the Daoxue. All this is only too well known. We're talking of 135, 124 before our era. And with these measures, there goes the principle that appointments as officials should be based on character, quality, and merit rather than favoritism or sponsorship. Well, now you have to wait until perhaps 100 of our era, 200 years later, for effective results of this to take place. Let me point out the figures which we have, which may or may not be correct. They are perhaps rhetorical. The figures for the pupils at the Taishir start with 50. Supposedly by 150 of our era, 200 years later, they have reached 30,000. But I must say, I find this figure somewhat difficult to believe. My own calculations are that there were in Chang'an some 30,000 officials, 100,000 other officials running the empire, 30,000 students at an academy would, I think, be a high proportion, of which perhaps many countries today might be conceivably proud. And we find that while there was attention devoted to the study of the Wu Jing in the later part of Western Han, this had grown far, far deeper by, again, the same sort of time, perhaps, say, 100 before our era, and let it alone, with the inscription of those texts on stone to be a replica which all scholars and students could adopt as the approved version, which takes place not until 178 of our era. Sometime after the habit of engraving inscriptions had been growing. And also, despite the statements that certain texts should be banned from study, this is in the great statement of 135 before our era, I think we are far from certain that, in effect, such a ban was implemented and took force. Now let me turn to the religious changes. Han inherited from Qin a worship of the Sidi and increased these to five when it took its place as empire, as an empire. Religious emphasis was renewed a century later, about 115, when we find an emperor regularly attending the worship of those five, and when we find regular official cults being addressed by the emperor to other deities, Ho Tu in 114 and Tai Yi in 113. And now for the change. In about 30 before our era, and it's a change which does not take place without considerable discussion and reversion. It's a change from worshipping those deities at sites which are at a distance from the capital, a change to worshipping Qian in the bounds of Chang'an at the south and probably D in the north. And the change is not accepted without dispute. It's instituted, it's changed again, but eventually it comes so that by Eastern Han times, there it is, and you have a state cult addressed to heaven. Dare I compare this change to that of the Reformation in Europe? I think it probably was of considerable significance. I would only say that in Europe it was from Catholic to Protestant. In China it would seem more likely to have been the other way around. Now, bound up with all this is the doctrine of the link between heaven and the exercise of imperial sovereignty, by virtue of the well-known doctrine of the Tianming. And Han writings, Western Han writings, refer to this as applying to pre-imperial times, by the kings of Joe. And it's only from about 33 onwards, when Tien was adopted as the subject of state worship, it's only from then that we find the idea of Tianming being applied to the Han dynasty, to be exploited and propagated first by Wang Man, for whom nobody has anything except a word of curse, but who, I believe myself, laid the foundations in many ways of the Chinese empires. It's only from then onwards and in Eastern Han that we do find Tianming being adopted for Han dynasty. My fourth subject were hierarchies, the recognition of grades being inbuilt, being an inescapable characteristic of Chinese way of life, and provoking, as this did, reactions against the restrictions. Hierarchy is seen in social terms, regulating precedence within a family, selection of names, use of titles, conduct of funerals. It all comes in then, depending exactly where you are. And Kungzi certainly recognized the importance of hierarchies in social grades. They are seen in the constant, repeated contrast between the Junzi, the man of quality, and the Xiaoran. This was perhaps Kungzi's addition to this particular subject, because these are distinctions which do not depend on birth. They recognize the force of different human qualities and attitudes. They recognize nobility of character as against base motives. And the Junzi is perhaps seen as the ideal, the Xiaoran as that, the place of most of the men and women whom one meets in the world. It's a constant, recurrent theme, as we know, in the teachings of Kungzi and his disciples. But now for the development, the appreciation of distinctions which come from completely different motives. Distinctions of rank not concerned primarily with human character, human motives, or human intentions. They are distinctions concerned with the value, with the ability of people to take part in the great task of organizing mankind and directing his services to the most useful ends. Rank is going to depend on what is useful rather than what is praiseworthy. And we can see marked steps to this change, certainly in the middle part of Western Han, and growing to much greater degree in the forceful measures of Sui, Tang, and such distinctions of that sort, I submit, are not really to be attributed to Kungzi the Great. We're still not finished with this question of hierarchy, because ranks come in again when they are imposed by legal administrative authority by a comparatively few men on the great majority of the population in a universal way, by rulers over the ruled. Yes, this had been practiced to a point in the Zhanghuo, but we find in Qin and Western Han, and indeed later Han, we find this whole system of declaring social rank of an individual, a rank which carried with it certain obligations and certain privileges, such as the tenure of land which you worked. Now, these sort of hierarchies, these distinctions were not done from the point of view of extolling the character of a man or woman. They derived from administrative necessity and the needs of government. Again, I don't think Kunze would have known much about that. And in fact, those distinctions amounted to 20 grades, carrying with them different privileges as you rose up in the scale. Well, let me now turn to the question of the kingdom and kings of Zhou. And you'll read that the founding kings of Zhou, their way of government was taken as a model in Western Han times, to which all should strive to follow, in the same way as the heroes, the exemplars of government and deportment were seen in the figures of Yao and Shun. And concentration on Zhou is deliberately stronger than that on its two predecessors of Xia and Yin. It is seen in Han times somewhat exceptionally in 114 before our era, with a decree to search for the descendants of the House of Zhou and to confer a nobility on their senior member. The nobility being just about the highest mark of honor that a government could give. I said this was exceptional because this nobility was not given for merit to the state. It was not given thanks to a relationship to the imperial house, but for that reason only. And it was exceptional because it lasted for so long, despite breaks in continuity. The line was restored, it was given extra honors, and it lasted right through until 37 of our own era, a very long time for a nobility to last. And we may note, well, coming back to those two major changes I talked about, we may note that the major enhancements of status date from 65 and 44, and then even more especially, 8 before our era and 4 after our era. My point here is the comparatively late growth in the attention and praise paid to Zhou. The same process can be observed over the history of the praise for Zhou Gong, Duke of Zhou, as he's sometimes called, sometimes featuring in early Western Han pronouncements, but it doesn't really come in. He comes in historically in 87 before our era as a rhetorical device to support the position of somebody who is supporting a young monarch not yet ready to rule. It's mentioned then in 87, but it's Zhou Gong is mentioned with far greater force than before, again in the time of Wang Mang, and we have sacrifices set up to him in the year one of our era. And he's frequently invoked by the memorialists of Eastern Han. Let me revert for a moment to the person of Kunze, associated directly not with Zhou, but with the House of Yin. And we've got to wait for the time of Mei Fu, a poet who flourished 20 to 10 before our era, We have to wait for him for a definite plan to honor Kunze's descendants with the gift of a title in this connection as descendants of the Yin house. And we find sacrifices ordered by the first of the Eastern Han emperors in 29, and these go on. The emperors take a personal part in 72, 85, and 124. Now, what about the importance of Li, of rectitude, conventional behavior? Yes, of course, you've got it in the writings of the Zhangguo period. Of course, you've got it in the writings of Xunzi. Of course, you've got it in the famous anecdote whereby Shu Sun Tung brought the importance of Li to the attention of the first emperor. You can't just go on managing an empire from a horseback. You've got to pay attention to the way in which your court is concerned and governed and ordered. And of course, we see Li being important in some of the writings of the Wu Jing, which were glorified in 124. But we are in some difficulties if we try to assess how important attention to Li really was in public life. We've got three received treatises concerning Li. Only one, the Yili, can be shown for certain to date before Eastern Han times. We have a growing attention to the subject in Eastern Han. Look at the great increase in the number of commentaries to these texts. We have highly detailed rules of behavior which apply, as stated in Li, applying only to the privileged classes. We simply don't know how far these were effective in living practice. When we read the Li Ji, the Zhou Li, or whatever it is, what are we reading? Orders for what should occur? Prescriptions? Are we reading descriptions of what actually did occur? And without further documentation, I don't know whether we're ever going to be able to find the answer. And we also have to ask ourselves about Li. Yes, here it is, formalized, beautifully formalized as part of the civilized way of life of an empire. All right, what have we got? Have we actually got a remnant of what I will call folklore, something which was practiced in early communities whose motives have long been forgotten, overlaid with something which makes it acceptable and indeed obligatory in a society? I don't know. That is a question which we have to leave. Well, so far we have traced a number of elements of Confucianism of later times whose existence in some form may be seen in Western Han with a pattern that emerges, their growing importance, particularly when we come to Eastern Han. But I think it would still be rash to see the formation of an established, approved, orthodox system of values and modes of thought as yet. It's too early, in my view, I submit this, to do so. Let us look at the evidence of the writers and literature and scholarship of the times. The bibliographical list of writings in the Hanshu, chapter 30, names 53 specialists in Ru writings. 20 date from Western Han, ranging from the time of the first Han Emperor right on to Yang Xiong, and they include writers such as Jia Yi, Lu Jia, Dong Zhongshu, long accepted as highly important thinkers and writers, with a long-term effect on the growth of Confucianism. I simply point out that very few of these people ever held high office. And in particular, the importance of Dong Zhongshu has, in my view, been greatly overstated by later writers. Some of those who are listed did reach high office. Ni Kuan for one, Gongsun Hong for another, who was chancellor. They are credited with the writings. Those writings have not survived. Liu Shang, we're going on now to 2620 before our era, indeed has surviving writings, and he exercised a profound influence on literature and mode of thought. Liu Shang took no part in government. The notes written by Ban Gu to 12 specialists in the Analects name figures who took first place in its study. They date noticeably from late in Western Han, 70, 60, or 20 years BCE, or 20 years later. They're coming to that time, which I am suggesting was crucial for a change, that time of the reign of Xuandi and Yuandi. Yuandi came to the throne in 48 before our era. These indications, and they are nothing more than indications, are in accord with the pattern which we have already noticed. And if we move on to Eastern Han, for which unfortunately we have no corresponding list of literature, what do we see? Some high officials who had a scholarly training. I put the names there on the list. Di Wulun, Yuanan, Chen Zhong. We have critics of government and public life who had not had a scholarly training. Zhou Xiang, Huang Qin, Chen Fan, the most conspicuous ones. We have those people with a scholarly background who never reached high office, Zhong Zhong, Cao Bao, He Chang. We have two men with a scholarly background who did, Lu Gong, who became chancellor in 101, Yang Zhen, who became supreme commander in 122. So despite all that has been suggested to show that certain Confucian elements advanced in Western Han and then in Eastern Han, there is, I submit, much to show that this cannot be taken for granted. We cannot say for certain that such a way of thought colored the practice of public life of Eastern Han effectively. We have protests against the oppressive, severe, unjust, corrupt government of officials voiced many occasions between 75 and 159. There appears to be no certainty that training of officials as based on the ethics and Li of the five classics were necessarily promoted and established an orthodox point of view and standard of behavior. Now, let me also say the great hope was training officials in this lovely classical way based on these fine approved texts of our elders. This would attract men, I can't say men and women, I'm sorry to say, this would attract men to serve in public life and officials. Well, maybe it did, but also there is considerable evidence to show that some very well-known scholars who were expounding just this literature deliberately refused to take office. It had not succeeded in setting up a career that was attractive to everyone. And in intellectual terms, I'm going to point to some movements or ideas which were not in accord with a later system or model which can be called Confucian. First of all, the Wuxing, five phases, which in many ways runs counter to a belief in the supremacy of Tian, of heaven. If you're going to say that rule of the world is the gift, the charge, the destiny imparted by heaven, can you also say that it is regulated by the movements of the Wuxing, who take their turn one after another? Also, there is the theory, and Wuxing in itself does not come into public life until perhaps 50 or so before our era. Secondly, we have the theory of the Sun Tung, whereby the past is judged and earlier regime may be removed from a direct place in the line of succession. This is set out elaborately, very clearly, in a highly suggestive chapter of the Chun Chu Fan Lu, and it lies in the background of arguments which were voiced and summarized in 79 of our era. And it runs directly against attempts to trace the ancestry of a dynasty directly through mythological stages to the Yellow Emperor or Yao and Shun. Now, in the third point, it is likely, or perhaps probable, that this idea of the Sun Tung, the three dispensations which follow one another, and as one goes, a predecessor is relegated to a higher level and forgotten about, this idea of the Sun Tung probably took an important place in texts which were described as Wei or apocryphal. We have to be very cautious here because we only have fragments of the Wei left to us. But we cannot and must not discount their importance. They enjoyed considerable patronage by the imperial house of Eastern Han, who ordered their circulation at a high level in 57 before our era. And it's only from 267, 200 years later, that these Weishu were declared corrupt and had to be banned. And there were several movements to do so later, showing fairly clearly that the order of 267 cannot have been particularly effective. As a fourth movement in intellectual development of this time, I point to a distinction, a stress is paid on a distinction of between Ji, substance, and one pattern. I would love to call this form and matter, but that would only confuse things rather badly. It's attention paid to the real substance of what is going on. I think it's probably on the next one, if we can get it.
I'm afraid you didn't give it to me.
Never mind. Attention to substance, the reality of what you're doing, as against the one, the decor, the icing on top of the cake. Are you going to put more importance in what the cake really tastes like and is? how it satisfies your hunger, or on the icing at the top, which may increase its flavour. Now, there seems to have been a very considerable distinction here, which has been overlooked by those who study Chinese intellectual thought. It's there in the writings. If you, it springs at you. Maybe the later masters of what I will call Confucian thought had got over this by then and took no account of it, but it's there in Han writings such that it does not have to be explained. The first chapter of that fascinating and most valuable text, the Yin Tie Lun, the Discourses on Salt and Iron, the very first speech mentions this distinction. And we also find references to the Zhijia, the specialist on substance, and the Wenjia, the specialists who put all importance into one. It's there, it's not always been recognized later. Now, how am I doing for time? You've got to go, I know, and thank you very much. But shall I go on talking, or have they had enough?
Well, maybe you could come to a general conclusion.
Come to a conclusion. I'll see what we can do about that. Yes, I was going to point out how adoption of a correct approved system was the obvious thing to do in Tang times as against certain other developments. But I still have my grave doubts before accepting that something such as a formalized or formulated Confucianism existed in these early empires. I would say that there are four stages whereby we can see a change coming about. Stages or incidents. First, the late years of Xuandi and Yuandi, let's say 48 to 33 before our era, when there were major attempts to improve the strict terms and methods of government. You have that conference of the Stone Cundit to review the proper place of scholarly texts. I think this is one crucial time when changes occur. Secondly, I would point to the work of Liu Xiang and his son Liu Xin in collecting and collating texts and forming thereby the imperial library with its consequent shape and the form that he gave to the classification of literature. I don't think he intended to do so, but it happened as a result. The third time at which I would say there's a change, those formative periods, the years of Wang Mang, 9 to 24 of our era, an open propagandist aim to claim we are reenacting the work of the kings of Zhou, and we are rejecting much of Han intellectual movement. And support was lent to Wang Mang by Liu Xiang and Liu Xin. That's your third point, 9 to 24 of our era. And as a fourth one, I would point to the short reign of Zhang Di, 75 to 88 of our era, highly intensive attention to intellectual and scholarly questions. You see it again in that set of discussions in 79 before our era. And you see in the account that we have of those discussions attention to some of the matters which we have been talking about earlier this afternoon. I submit that we have a very different story from the idea of a constant, unchanged ideology radically different from Qin and characterizing 400 years of a continuum of the Han dynasties. And myself, I would not care to use the term the victory of Confucianism.